fan to visit her property. Erica Olivares wasn't impressed.
I just told him, you know, obviously what had happened, how we'd been infected, but also how disappointed I was about how the local council had treated us and the environment agency. You know, we'd had no help, especially over Christmas Day. We were totally abandoned. We had no hot food, no hot drink, nothing.
Five of the six Britons jailed after a Greenpeace protest in the Arctic have arrived back in London. They've been released as part of a Russian amnesty. One of them says spending time in jail was torture. The Foreign Secretary says those responsible for a bomb that killed five people in Lebanon must be brought to justice. William Hague says he strongly condemns the blast in Beirut. An inquest into the death of a British doctor who died in custody in Syria has been opened and adjourned. UK authorities are still awaiting post-mortem examination results for Dr. Abbas Khan, whose family say he was murdered days before his release. And yesterday was the UK's biggest online shopping day ever. Retail websites saw a 15% rise in traffic compared with Boxing Day last year. That's the latest. I'm Simon English. BCFM.
The message that I'm bringing you is clear. It is concise. And there can be no mistake in its interpretation. You must wake up now or be enslaved. The war has begun many years ago. The war was declared by our enemies upon us. You had better listen.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Do our own intelligence services spend more of our time and money on spying on us than they do on our so-called enemies? Certainly looks that way. So, what are they so afraid of? We hear also Edward Snowden, the whistleblower from the National Security Agency's Christmas message. And it's a story that links terrorism in Europe, carried out by NATO, to the United States 9/11 and London's 7/7 bombings. It's got to be the biggest suppressed story in the Western world. Our media won't touch it, but international satellite channel RT do. We hear from them this week. Plus, the brilliant but little heard from independent pressure group Independent Diplomat. We hear their founder Karl Ross's views on the Commonwealth meeting that British trade missions to China. Also, speaking of which, Hinkley Point's new nuclear power station to be run by a totalitarian one-party state which executes some of its critics. Will this ever really happen? And finally, a bit of a nasty one for me. We'll do this at the end of the hour. This time last year, I received death threats by phone from an international terrorist organisation. I'll let you hear them and explain what happened when I went to the police. But I think we'll start this week with Edward Snowden and his Christmas message. Martin, I mean, this seems to me to be the big story of the year, and in fact combines in a way with, I mean, it's been so much ramifications, stuff trickling out. The Guardian say they've only actually told 1% of all the information that they've got as part of the stories, and with the New York Times, etc. The fascinating thing for me is it coincided with the arrival of the Bilderberg meeting on exactly the same day as the Bilderberg meeting started in June, so there was the first revelation from Edward Snowden. What are your thoughts about how important this story is and what the impact has been?
Well, it's had a big impact at the geopolitical level, because the thing that worries most of other countries, for example, Brazil and Germany, put a motion through the UN condemning the US over their spying. And what they're particularly worried about is the industrial espionage aspects of the spying. It's kind of undermined completely all of the World Trade Organization negotiations about trade treaties and so on, because people aren't going to negotiate if they think they're being bugged. And that's the main problem.
I mean, surely,
from
Martin,
that point
everyone's
of view.
Doing it. The Russians are doing it. The Chinese are doing it. Anybody with a big, powerful security state is spying on everything that's going on the internet, as they can of telephone communications.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem with that is demonstrated by Snowden's case. A 27-year-old subcontractor is able to walk out of the building with everything that you've uncovered on everybody else on an MP3, and that's the problem. I mean, the Russian secret services, I understand, have gone back to having paper files with "top secret for your eyes only" stamped on them. And, of course, the NSA can't bug that.
Well,
the Iraqi resistance and the Taliban, for example, they don't use electronic equipment because they know it's bugged.
Look, there's another aspect to this. One of the things we know on September the 11th, it certainly seems as if NORAD, the North American Air Defense Radar System, was compromised. Viruses or hacking through the operating system of the NORAD computers was allowing blips to appear on computer screens of aircraft that weren't actually there. So these marvelous technological systems are actually fairly easy, in layman's terms, fairly easy to actually compromise in one way or another, to slip something in under the radar and cause the computer that you thought was reliable to actually do something completely unpredictable, even at the top military levels.
Yes, but don't forget that was the blips that were appearing on the screens were part of exercises that were supposedly being run that day. So people, at one point, somebody turns to somebody else, is this real or is this the exercise? So they were putting blips on the screens as part of an exercise. In any case, these systems are incredibly hackable. I mean, the Iranians have already taken down two of the American drones, and Hezbollah a few years ago, after the Rafiq Hariri assassination, who was the Prime Minister of Lebanon, they were taking the blame for that, and they gave a press conference where they showed the video feed from the Israeli drone, which they claimed had fired the missile which caused the death of Hariri and his entourage. All of these, the more complex systems become, the more vulnerable they are to attack.
Well, one organisation that's fighting back against, at least against the takeover of the internet, is this Open Rights Group, ORG. Jim Killick, one of their directors, has written on the 23rd of December, that's what, the day before Christmas Eve, please help ORG monitor UK blocking and filtering. So if you're getting a bit frustrated that your computer isn't finding what you want it to find, go to blocked.org.uk. The Open Rights Group is putting together tools to track what's blocked and where. We intend to develop that current site, blocked.org.uk, into a means to request a check across the UK using probes based in each network. We intend to make it easy for anyone to check whether their site's blocked and find out where, so that their complaints can be made as needed. Because what's happening, obviously, with these new camera and web filters is loads and loads of sites out there, thousands of websites across the country and probably across the world too, that are completely legitimate reasons that people are trying to get to, they're now blocked too.
Well, yes, and the internet provides all sorts of possibilities and all sorts of dangers, doesn't it? And we're all working in that field now.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Edward Snowden then and his Christmas message. It's only fairly short, but this is why he's speaking, presumably, from Moscow.
Hi, and Merry Christmas. I'm honoured to have a chance to speak with you and your family this year. Recently, we learned that our governments, working in concert, have created a system of worldwide mass surveillance, watching everything we do. Great Britain's George Orwell warned us of the danger of this kind of information. The types of collection in the book, microphones and video cameras, TVs that watch us, are nothing compared to what we have available today. We have sensors in our pockets that track us everywhere we go. Think about what this means for the privacy of the average person. A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. And that's a problem, because privacy matters. Privacy is what allows us to determine who we are and who we want to be. The conversation occurring today will determine the amount of trust we can place both in the technology that surrounds us and the government that regulates it. Together, we can find a better balance, end mass surveillance, and remind the government that if it really wants to know how we feel, asking is always cheaper than spying. For everyone out there listening, thank you and Merry Christmas.
Asking is cheaper than spying. I like that. And they don't bother to ask half the time. Mind you, they are talking to, of course, to the leaders of the Taliban.
Well, indeed. It's quite clear that there's no legal basis for a lot of this net spying that's been going on. And that's the important point. So if it's not legal, it's illegal. We have data protection acts and so on, but they've obviously been completely ignored by the spies. Ultimately, that means somebody needs to be arrested and prosecuted.
It sounds to me like we're heading for some sort of a dystopia. He's talking about 1984, Orwell's 1984 there. I mean, what it does do is it gives the intelligence services, certainly if they're linked, or they're selling information or they're giving information to big, powerful corporations, we can see the way we're heading here. And they are actually courting these big corporations, saying, how can we help you? How can we help your business?
Yeah, well, what's happened, of course, ironically, is that the big corporations like Google and so on are being undermined completely by this, because people who were thinking of buying, say, a Google system in the other part of the world say, well, yeah, but the NSA uses this to spy on us. So that they're now developing their own internet hubs in places like Brazil, because they don't want what they're really worried about is industrial espionage. They don't want US corporations having access to their privileged information about, you know, what their strategies are and what their research and developments is up to. Yes. So it's undermining completely all of these trade deals at the highest level.
There's a fantastic picture of Angela Merkel on one of the newspapers over the last few weeks saying, dear Mr. Obama, she's talking on her mobile phone, are you listening to my phone calls? And I mean that, but surely, I mean, the US and Germany, for example, have got a very, very powerful strategic alliance anyway. It doesn't really matter, does it, if the NSA is listening to the German
president? Well, I mean,
president.
What we've been suggesting in the whole of the first hour is that the intelligence services, in fact, are not answerable to the democratic politicians. And just think of the power that the intelligence services have if they know what the democratic politicians are up to in their private lives. So, for example, they could say to somebody, you know, you will be voting with us to invade Iraq, otherwise everybody's going to find out about your personal peccadilloes. And that is how it works. That is the situation. They've become far too big for their boots. The democratic politicians don't even know what they're up to. I mean, it became clear in Britain, for example, that the snooper's charter, as it was called, was knocked back by the Commons, and they said, we're not going to allow you to have all of these powers that you're asking. And then it turns out that GCHQ have been doing this all along anyway, even though they didn't have a legal basis for it.
But there isn't
and that proves that that's illegal. That's like stealing a bottle of water during a riot. It's illegal.
There isn't
and people should be
there's
prosecuted.
There's no proper oversight of this at all either. You were talking about prime ministerial power. The Intelligence and Security Committee is not actually a normal parliamentary committee at all. It's handpicked by the Prime Minister with people like Hazel Blears for whatever reason she was picked. I mean, she's not exactly a loyal Labour MP. And there's a whole selection of people in there, some of whom are actually still in the pay of the defence industry on that parliamentary committee, even though they're still MPs. So the point really being that there is no oversight, that the intelligence services know if they do anything naughty, illegal or whatever, that they will just simply be able to get away with it.
Well, that's right. And ultimately, of course, what we're talking about, well, who do the intelligence services work for? Well, they work for themselves. You know, they've got a bureaucratic desire to be bigger and have more bangs for their buck and all the rest of it. But ultimately, of course, what happens to a top intelligence agency is they go to work for the corporations. So the former head of MI5, Jonathan Evans, who mysteriously resigned after the debacle of the Olympic Games, can't imagine why that was. He went to, you know, he said, I'm going to, and where's he ended up? He's headed up as head of security at Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. Banking corporation. So, of course, these spooks end up running private security for the corporations. And, of course, they've got that in their minds even while they're working for the government.
Now, I mentioned the Bilderberg Conference. That was quite a big event this year in June in Watford, in Hertfordshire. by far the biggest protest attendance there's ever been at a Bilderberg conference. I'm rather happy, proud to say, between 2,000 and 3,000 people sitting on a bank a mile away from the conference centre, looking across. You and I were both there, Martin. One of the things that strikes me, though, is it's very difficult to get behind the curtains of these conferences to find out what's really going on inside. One of the things I noticed that Sherard Cowper-Coles was there representing BAE Systems, and also the boss of EADS. So the biggest arms manufacturers in Europe are both in there with these Bilderbergers. We have politically, you've got Ed Balls in there and George Osborne. One wonders, you know, are we getting Labour Party and Conservative Party economic policy? Are we getting Bilderberg economic policy? Then you've also, poor old David Cameron couldn't resist it, could he? He skipped across, even though he wasn't on the official list. He skipped across too. But of course, by being in that conference, swearing themselves to secrecy, they're actually breaking the ministerial code, all of them. And more importantly, David Cameron is the person in charge of policing the ministerial code. So there seems to be a kind of... if the Cameron himself finds it impossible to actually keep to the rules he's supposed to, and this is a blatant example, really, linking up with international finance, big business, royalty from all around Europe, well, he really shouldn't be in there.
Well, Michael Meacher, of course, the MP for Oldham, was outside with the protesters. And if I was Ed Balls and I'd been invited, I might have gone along to Bilderberg, but I would have made a point of coming out to talk to the protesters. But, of course, he didn't do that. And, of course, the suspicion has to be that the policy is being decided behind closed doors. Essentially, it's a meeting of the big beasts in finance and the military and so on, and the politicians are also invited. Now, we can't really stop private sector organisations having a private meeting, but our elected politicians should have to justify going and should have to say what was discussed when they went. And Michael Meacher actually put an early day motion into the Commons the following week saying, well, you know, we want to report back, you know, you were in there, what were you talking about? And of course they refused to reply. Well, they should have replied. And of course the previous year when Osborne went, he took his Treasury civil servants with him, and he said, I don't have to report back on the meeting because it was a private meeting for private people. Well, hang on a minute, you've got your Treasury team there on the taxpayers'
also cost
ticket.
About £1 million of taxpayers' money to do the policing for the conference.
Indeed.
This year.
Indeed.
Yeah, lots of...
So the gap between public and private is being constantly undermined, so that the publicly elected politicians are ultimately becoming the handmaidens of these unelected wealthy people.
Well, you mentioned Michael Meacher there. Maybe he would come out and talk to the protesters.
Well, no, Michael Meacher was
No, he was outside. But he
was invited.
But actually, I can remember back in 2003, it was the Palace of Versailles in France, just outside Paris, where the Bilderberg meeting was being held. We were standing, just a couple of us, taking photographs and things, and out came the Greek finance minister. He'd had enough in there, that the atmosphere was too stuffy, and he wanted to get a bit of real life on the outside. He'd come out also because the price of cigarettes in the hotel was too much, and he wanted to come and have a chat with us. We spent about 10-15 minutes having a chat with the guy. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how it's all transpired, that actually Greece has been one of the worst hit by the international financial crisis and the debt crisis. Greece has been absolutely pummeled, and yet there you've got a Greek finance politician who's actually prepared to come out of the Bilderberg conference, where all these banks and these powerful people are gathered, to come and talk to ordinary people on the street.
Well, I think that's, if Bilderberg wants to actually reassure people that it's a legit organisation, then people should come out and chat to protesters and others outside in order to show that there's nothing to hide. What I suspect goes on in Bilderberg is that it's not a place where they get together and make plots. What happens is things have been decided somewhere else. We don't quite know where or how. Maybe on yachts, like the yacht that's Deripaska's yacht, where both Mandelson and Osborne were guests of Nathan Rothschild. You begin to wonder, what on earth is going on there? We've got a Russian oligarch on his yacht, and Nathan Rothschild, who's a part of the Rothschild banking dynasty, organises a party where the senior...
Oh, he's a Bullingdon Club member,
yes,
as well.
Yes, the senior person from the Conservative Party and the senior person from the Labour Party are all on this yacht together, talking about what exactly? What were they discussing?
Well, reminiscing about the days at the Bullingdon Club.
Well, Mandelson wasn't in the Bullingdon Club, but Mandelson definitely is a Bilderberg attendee this year and previous years. And of course, he's regarded by many Labour activists as very, very pro the city and so on. I mean, he openly says it, you know, he doesn't believe in nationalisation, etc. The suspicion has to be that all of these things are being cooked up behind the scenes. For example, you know, what the policy is going to be on austerity for Greece, for example. When you've got the Greek finance minister coming out of the meeting, I suspect that what happens is not everybody who gets invited to Bilderberg is there to make decisions. They're there to be told what other decisions have been taken and how they've got to fit in.
The Greek finance minister even tried to sneak the list out because it hadn't been revolved. Yeah. The list of people who were inside, but yeah, he got stopped by security on the way out and they took the list off of him. So, I mean, it's interesting that there are maybe, I mean, for example, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, another person who was actually quite, goes to these Bilderberg meetings, but it's not, he's one of the politicians that they're trying to win over. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a couple of minutes of Michael Meacher MP, who actually came down to give a talk to the various protesters at this year's Bilderberg conference, and also got the very first ever debate on Bilderberg going in the House of Commons.
I came here today because this is a unique occasion in Western capitalism. These are our real leaders. These are the top brass of Western finance capitalism. The people who are here are the leaders, chairmen, chief executives of the top banks, of the biggest multinational companies, of UN institutions like the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, several EU commissioners, and politicians from the US, Canada, UK and EU. These people only come not to have a cozy discussion because they have an agenda which they have got to fix with their peers in order to concert their plans, in order, far as possible, to preserve or enhance their own interests, but having to take account of other people with power and how they can do that together as far as possible. That's what it is all about. That's why it is entirely secret. They do meet in Davos, in Switzerland, every year. The difference is that the press is present there, and the public, if they can get in. Here, they're half a mile away, and we can't get any closer, and you will not get any communique at the end. When Cameron goes to the EU Council, along with the other prime ministers of the other 27 EU states, even though it is open to the press, it's reported by the press, he always comes back to the House of Commons and is subject to an hour or more questioning by the Leader of the Opposition and every other MP who asks him a question in the House of Commons, usually on a Monday. If that happens with the EU Council, which we all know about, and which I have to say is not always on the most important issues, what about this, which is something very serious? Capitalism is in a very bad state. We've already had a triple dip. The Eurozone is continuing to go down. The EU shows no sign of recovery. The United States has made some recovery, but is beginning to slip a bit. China is still far below their normal rate of growth. Capitalism is in a very serious state. These people are meeting to decide what to do about their system.
Michael Meacher there, Labour MP. Martin, I suppose that's the point, isn't it? They're saying, oh, it's okay, we're just having a little chat, trust us. And yet, actually, the system that is basically their system, you've got the people that control most, by far, the majority of money in the Western world in there. It's not working for us.
No, I think it was very good that Michael Meacher turned up because it gives a younger generation some hope that not all politicians are completely corrupt. But of course, we've got Balls and Mandelson and
they're keeping mum on it. So
inside there, along with Osborne
and
Cameron,
if we can do what's happened there is Monday after the Bilderberg conference, whoever from Britain has been there comes to the House of Commons and gives a report.
Well, Michael Meacher did in fact raise Bilderberg in the House of Commons the following week, didn't he? And I think
he set an interesting precedent there.
Yes, and I think a lot of the young people, it was a predominantly young crowd who were protesting outside, they need to feel that, you know, politicians are not just a bunch of crooked chiselers. And I'm full marks to Michael Meacher for turning up, and full marks for the questions
who are the crooked chiselers? Answer, the bankers. Yeah. Mostly. I mean, most of the criticism seems to be thrown at politicians, but actually it's the bankers that mostly seem to be.
But the politicians are there to soak up the flack. That's the whole point about the politicians,
job,
isn't it?
Thank you. Right. Now I'm joined, I'm happy to say, by Tony Crofts from Clifton. Tony, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
Now, this is the government's addiction to the market and selling property. Now, apparently, you're trying to set up an alternative system here in Bristol whereby buying empty office buildings and converting them into affordable housing. Now, how are you going to be able to manage to do that? You've been on here a couple of times in the past. How are you getting on with that? Because you've done some sort of... I think the last time we spoke to you, you were doing some sort of community share issue.
We have launched a community share, yep, which has already raised nearly £150,000.
Well, well done. And is that enough to buy any properties yet?
We are very near making a bid now for a property just over that price. So we are getting very close to it.
Now, you're saying that the market in property in this country actually exaggerates the gap between the haves and the have-nots. How does it do that?
It's very simple. It's due to this pathetic fallacy that owning bricks and mortar is a way of getting rich. Because if you own a house that goes up and up in price, then you sell it to make all that money. The house you buy to replace it has also gone up equally in price, so you're still running as fast as ever to stay in the same place.
But well, I mean, what's the effect of that on people with no housing? I mean, there is a fair amount of social housing around, isn't there?
The effect on people with no housing who can't afford to buy or rent a house is none at all. The government's doing nothing about the housing crisis at all. All it's doing is encouraging big developers like Barratt's to build more new houses to sell them and encouraging more and more people into debt to buy them.
Well, with tiny little rooms, I might add, as
yeah,
well.
and this makes a lot of money for the big developers, and it makes extra profit for the money lenders, but it doesn't do anything to tackle the people who simply can't afford to buy or rent a house at all of their own.
But Tony, I mean, but people actually do want to own their own homes ultimately, and you're not offering them that, are you?
Everybody would like to own a stately home or a castle, but not everyone can afford to, Tony. And it's a fallacy. I mean, you know, Tony, if you take a mortgage out with interest, you're going to pay back twice as much as you borrowed. So if you borrow $100,000 to buy a house, you're going to pay back $200,000. No wonder the big bankers get such vast bonuses when they're selling all these 100% profit mortgages.
So isn't renting just as bad as paying the mortgage?
It shouldn't be if rents were properly controlled rather than let to go racing ahead. I mean, all the council houses that have been sold out, almost all of them have ended up in the hands of buy-to-let landlords who then re-let them at twice the rent. So, of course, the government has more and more to pay for housing benefit, and the rents are still out of the reach of ordinary working people.
So are you saying that we need to go back to big council housing estates, build those massive estates from the 1930s, 40s, 50s?
We do need a vast expansion of permanently affordable rented housing, let on secure long-term tenancies so people have got security in their homes. Because if you want people to work for low wages to rescue the economy, you've got to jolly well house them. We can't go back to the 19th century where all the workers were stuck in back-to-back houses with outside toilets, for goodness sake.
But, I mean, it sounds like you're saying we're not doing that at all, so we're on the road to disaster.
Well, we're not doing it at all. I mean, it can't be done by local councils, because as soon as they build anything, and Bristol City Council has only managed 37 affordable homes this year, as soon as they build them, they're obliged to offer them under right to buy for sale, which means they very quickly end up in the hands of buy-to-let landlords again. The only possible way is for local communities to produce their own housing and own it on behalf of the community so it stays permanently affordable. And that's what we're trying to organise.
So you're doing what the council's really failing to do and they've traditionally done in the past. So your £150,000, what's happening with that? And do you still need more money? Are you asking for more money? And you know, how
we're going to go on raising money to try and do more and more. But we are looking at present at a site just above that sum on which we could afford to put four floors of flats with a workshop or a cafe or something on the ground floor.
Martin, the macroeconomics of all this is we've got actually loads and loads and loads of empty offices. There's a kind of rent fixing going on in Bristol where the rents for these places are actually astronomically high. There isn't no proper market. If there was, then those offices wouldn't all be empty. People would be in them at lower rents. So is Tony's idea here a solution? Because, you know, you've got all those vast acres. I think, can you remind me how many acres? Because you worked it out, didn't you? How much?
It's about 60 acres of unlet offices in Bristol at present. And that's not just big tower blocks. It's also ordinary, what used to be homes in rows in streets, completely boarded up.
What do you make of what Tony's plan is here? To actually, not to be selling these flats or anything, but to keeping them in community ownership?
I think it's a great plan and I wish him every success with it. But I mean, I think Tony would be the first to accept that even if you were to be very successful and housed, I don't know, 20 or 30 people, we've got a waiting list of 14,000 in Bristol. Ultimately, I would see what you're doing as a kind of a catalyst for the local authorities to do what they should be doing. And of course, they need to change the regulations at the centre so that they can, in fact, build houses for people as they used to do.
And I hope we're building a model that other people elsewhere can also follow so that this thing builds up.
So what sort of a return are people getting? I mean, obviously, they're not going to be giving you their money that's built up this £150,000 reserve you've now got.
We
and committing it without some kind of decent return.
At the end of the first year, when we actually have units let, to be able to start paying people who've rented us money 3%, and as time goes on we ought to be able to work up to about 5%, which is a reasonable return.
And is that enough, do you think, to pull in more investment? The thing is, people are unlikely to give you any more money, Tony, until they've actually seen the results of what you're doing.
There are a lot of people who are looking for somewhere good to put their money that's going to be socially worthwhile and who are prepared to lend at reasonable rates.
So
I mean, the 150,000 has been coming in at the rate of about £10,000 a week so far.
So what sort of people have been putting the money your way? Because this is obviously what's needed. If you can actually convert these empty offices to low cost housing, you need to have that money coming in. What kind of people have got the money and are
the
prepared to
the kind of people who buy fair trade coffee and that kind of thing, the people who have a social conscience and a sense of social responsibility.
But what about the bucks? This is what it comes down to. Are they going to actually make more money or as much money as they would elsewhere?
Probably not, but they're choosing to make less money in order to do something worthwhile.
I mean, Martin, for example, even in ISAs and savings accounts, the actual interest rates nowadays aren't very much. It sounds to me like Tony's offering, you know, certainly no less than what people can get for their savings nowadays.
I think that's right. And if the local council were to or were allowed to do similar things, that the same would also be true. I mean, it's been mooted that offices should be bought up and turned into housing by the council using the pension funds of the council administrators. And apparently Manchester City Council have already found a way to do this, because the problem is not can it be done, the problem is can it be done legally, because the central government has made it impossible for councils to do the things that they ought to do.
Yeah.
But apparently in Manchester their legal officers have said yes, we can do this, and it's an inherently attractive idea, isn't it? We've got all of the 60 acres of empty offices which aren't doing anything. They could be bought up compulsorily or in some other mechanism, and as you say, I mean, actually a 5% return under current conditions is not bad at all. Mm. It's actually quite good.
Yes, quite.
If you put your money in the bank, you're not going to get that kind of return.
No, indeed.
Now, I notice on your website, Tony, which is www.aeobhousepeople. What does that AEOB stand for?
Abandoned empty office buildings.
Oh, okay. aeobhousepeople.org.uk. You've got a picture of the street round the back of the bear pit at the bottom of Stokes Croft. Fantastic photograph, because I mean 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 houses all blocked up, and any one of those could be used to house people. Now these are exactly the sorts of, I mean, these were built originally as houses for people to live in, been converted to offices and then just boarded up.
Yeah, they've been so for 2 years now.
And I mean, what is the point, Martin, of someone buying this, or, you know, the owners of this, what are they just trying to empty them so they can sell them on the open market?
Yeah, the point is that if you invest in property in the kind of distorted economy we've got here in Britain, then that's a way of just making money, just leaving it like that. It will gradually, as the property bubble picks up, they're making money on that. And of course, the other thing that people can do is they can borrow money against property. This is so. It's when you say, well, if you sell your house, you'll have to buy another one even more expensive. So you're on a treadmill. That's true, but you can also borrow against what you've got, and that's what allows this wealth effect to happen. So during the subprime mortgage bubble in the US, people were using their houses as cash machines, which of course led to a bubble and so on and so forth. We chucking funny money at the property market is the usual scam by which things are run in this country and in the US, and of course it's disastrous in the long run for everybody. It's the triumph of vested interests over common sense.
And the government is all about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
Robin Hood in reverse, absolutely.
The irony being, of course, that street you're talking about there, Cumberland Street, it actually used to be where the Hub Advice Centre for Homelessness, in fact, there's still some signs around the city. So if someone's forlorn person is following these signs, they'd eventually end up at this street, Cumberland Street, which used to be the place where people went for housing advice. What's your experience of the sorts of people that are getting in touch with you, Tony, wanting somewhere to live?
Well, I mean, there's a huge range of people, and most of them are working people who are in jobs and are simply not earning enough money to compete in this idiotic, unregulated market we have.
OK, well, Tony Cross, lovely to hear from you again. And the website again is www.aeobhousepeople.org.uk. Maybe you could just give us a phone number as well, Tony, for those who aren't on the internet, if people are interested in either getting somewhere to live as part of your organisation, helping out in some other way, or else investing in it.
0117 926 5931. It's 926-5931, Bristol.
Well, Tony Crofts, thanks very much for nipping in this Christmas tide and joining us. Shame you didn't bring any mince pies, though. Thanks very much. Now, Martin, on to our news, back to our news review of the year. Our next item is this one about Michael Hastings. He died in June of this year. He was a US investigative journalist, worked for Rolling Stone magazine. Can you just tell us a little bit about Rolling Stone? Because we don't see it here, but actually, I mean, I read it quite a lot online. I don't know about you.
Well, it was a product of the alternative culture of the 1960s and 1970s in the US, like the Village Voice in Greenwich and so on. And Matt Tybee is the person I mostly read from Rolling Stone. But, I mean, they were famous for putting out the stuff by Hunter S. Thompson and so on. So they're you know, they've got a track record.
Who's Hunter S. Thompson?
He's the guy who wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which became a film and so on. And what they call gonzo journalism. But anyway, I mean, Rolling Stone has got a reputation for being a credible source of alternative features and news.
Anyway, one of their star journalists was Michael Hastings. He was the guy that went embedded back in 2010, I think it was, to Afghanistan with General McChrystal, wasn't he? The head of the US forces there, and was actually simply writing what quotes that McChrystal said in Rolling Stone magazine. And he wasn't being very complimentary of the Obama government, was he, back at the White House?
No, and Hastings reported all of that, and that led to McChrystal being sacked, basically. And, of course, Hastings has now died in a very mysterious car accident, even though he was his friends and family are saying that he was investigating FBI, CIA stories. And, of course, the suspicion is that the people he's been investigating have had him bumped off, and he was himself worried about being bumped off. He didn't want to drive the car. He tried to suggest, he went to his friend and said, "Can I borrow your car? Because I'm worried about what's happening with my car." And it may or may not be the case that he's been assassinated, but frankly, the fact that he might be assassinated is absolutely credible.
Well, Mercedes have not commented on whether their car is hackable, whether it could have been hacked, but certainly Richard Clark, who was a former senior advisor at the White House, has said that it shows all the hallmarks of some kind of hack attack on the car. Anyway, let's hear now from good old Michael Hastings, who has done an incredible job writing also a book, which I had got at the end of November, beginning of December, fantastic book called The Operators. Anyway, here he is now talking about a related story. More information than he got whilst he was embedded with the US military over in Afghanistan.
An information operations cell, which is a cell that by definition is trained to conduct psychological operations and military deception, was asked by Lieutenant General Caldwell and his staff to use their skills on visiting U.S. senators and other VIPs. Now, the cell, this I.O. cell, was led by a gentleman named Lieutenant Colonel Michael Holmes. Lieutenant Colonel Holmes raised objections to being asked to do this. He said, hey, I'm an I.O. cell. Information operations is only supposed to be used for foreign audiences. It's a really bad idea to be using my team, because we specialize in psychological operations and whatnot, to be doing this, but the pressure kept on mounting on him to you know, focus all his efforts not on the Afghans but on Americans visiting. Finally, he received a written order to this effect: you know, focus all your efforts on essentially manipulating visiting senators. He then took that order and went to a lawyer, a JAG lawyer. The lawyer said, yes, this is not right. This is illegal. Another lawyer confirmed that opinion, and then Caldwell's people refined the order to say, oh, well, you're only looking at public records, but then they launched a retaliatory investigation into the whistleblower, Colonel Michael Holmes. And after he tried to get his complaints redressed and said, hey, I was attacked because I'm a whistleblower, I was investigated because I'm a whistleblower, that also had no impact, and so eventually he decided to go public with his story. Psychological operations and information operations are essentially just ways to influence the population. Now, the key is that for IO and PSYOPs, you're only supposed to do those on foreign populations, on the enemy. You know, and now there's another branch, public affairs, which is which you're allowed to then use your information on the American population. The key difference is that in information operations and in PSYOPs, you're allowed to lie. You're allowed to mislead. Where in public affairs, in theory at least, you're not supposed to do that. And by using information operations who know how to conduct psychological operations in the process that would traditionally be held for public affairs, you're corrupting the entire process. And you know, one of the interesting things has been to see the reaction from the military. Of course, I commend General Petraeus for launching an investigation, but what we also know from a series of anonymous leaks is that the military doesn't think they've done anything wrong here. And that to me is truly disturbing, and what the actual bigger story is. This very aggressive effort that Caldwell has been at the forefront from to tear down the wall between information and propaganda, between public affairs and information operations, to say it's one giant playing field now, and to allow the Pentagon and the military to be able to target not just foreign populations with their propaganda, but target the U.S. populations, whether it's on Facebook, on social networking sites, or visiting congressmen.
Well, the voice there of now passed away journalist, investigative journalist, writing for Rolling Stone magazine, writing books, etc., Michael Hastings. Martin, the story he was working on, his wife, Elise Jordan, says he was investigating the new director of the CIA, John Brennan, and his war on the press. I mean, this is really the idea being, essentially, that these information operation cells are actually being directed actually against the press and newspapers. I mean, this is not what these organisations were set up for. Another thing he's saying there is that the Pentagon is spending $4.7 billion dollars every year of public money, annually employing 27,000 psychological operations, marketing and public relations staff around the world. The mission of these staff is to push the Pentagon line into the West's national newspapers and broadcast bulletins. I mean, that's not what we pay our taxes for, surely, to force the Pentagon or military lines into our news.
Well, yes, and it would be bad in any case, but at least we ought to know about it if that's what's happening. But I think it's fairly clear that the intelligence establishment in the Western countries has become completely out of control. It's been out of control for many years, and of course they are operating to their own agenda, but they're also operating to the agenda of the companies which supply military equipment, because they've got a vested interest in wars and so on, and also the bankers who are manipulating the financial system.
Well, this guy,
there's a massive amount of overlap between
this
the two.
This guy he was investigating when he died, John Brennan, is now the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. His past jobs include Homeland Security Advisor, National Counterterrorism Center Director, and he lives in New Jersey, United States. An analyst for the CIA. He's also been involved a lot in politics. He compiled information for President Bush's daily top secret intelligence briefings. Now, this guy seems, if you try and investigate him, you could end up dead.
Well, I mean, there are many suspicions around what happened with this car accident in which Michael Hastings died this year. But frankly, what we know about Western intelligence services, I mentioned in Posimato earlier, the investigations by the Italian police force into terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. He published a book which came out in December 2012, so it's just a year ago that it came out. It's called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, and it's based upon an Italian police investigation. Most of the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s was being run by the intelligence services, which means from London, from Washington. These people aren't just bugging phones. They're also engaged in terrorism. And we need the police forces, something like the police service of Northern Ireland, perhaps, to get in there, find out who the bad guys are, and bust them.
Or something a bit more positive now, and this is Carl Ross we're about to hear from this organisation, Independent Diplomat. I mean, we had a pretty horrific situation with the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting over in Sri Lanka this year, and now the Sri Lankan president, who is a genocidal chap, I mean, he's tens of thousands of Tamils were killed by his army, deliberately civilians, and now he's in charge of the Commonwealth. Amazing, really, to think of this. And there are a lot of diplomats out there, British diplomats and those from other countries who are actually being quite outspoken, many of them ex-diplomats, obviously, because if they were to be outspoken, they may lose their jobs. And so let's have a listen now to Carl Ross, and he was interviewed by Emily Matthias on BBC Newsnight earlier this year.
Joining me now from New York is Carl Ross, a British diplomat who resigned in 2004 after giving secret evidence on how the British government had exaggerated the case for invading Iraq. He now runs a diplomatic advisory group, Independent Diplomat, and joins us now. Carl Ross, thanks for your time this evening. Let's start at the beginning then. Was David Cameron right to go to Sri Lanka?
Personally, I don't feel he was right. The scale of human rights abuses and atrocities in Sri Lanka are huge, and I think the fact that the Commonwealth Summit is taking place in Sri Lanka and that the Rajapaksa regime will be the chair of the Commonwealth for the next couple of years is a travesty and a complete embarrassment for the Commonwealth, and I don't think Britain should have endorsed it.
But it's hard to argue, isn't it, that this in itself was a trade mission, particularly when you hear about those robust conversations that are being reported by Downing Street?
I don't think it was a trade mission. I think it was driven by some sort of British desire that, you know, we need to keep the Commonwealth together, we need to keep it relevant, and if the UK were to boycott CHOGM, then that would be a very big deal indeed and would actually put a question mark over the future of the Commonwealth. But I think there should be a question mark over the future of the Commonwealth. What is the point of it if it's not about human rights and democracy? Indeed, the Commonwealth in 1991 said that that was the point of the Commonwealth. So one can equally accuse the Commonwealth itself of great hypocrisy.
I guess you could argue, though, that by staying away, by not entertaining dialogue with countries that you don't like, you're not helping human rights at all. You're just making them into enemies.
That's always the argument here, constructive engagement or boycott, and that was the argument over South Africa and apartheid. And I think South Africa gave a pretty convincing answer to that when apartheid finally ended. The ANC leaders, the supporters of a democratic South Africa, said that the isolation of South Africa was tremendously important in encouraging them and in pressurizing the minority white regime to give up. So I think that that argument has been convincingly answered in that case. And it's never true anyway. I mean, these governments that engage in sort of constructive engagement allegedly over human rights, that's not their real motive. Their real motive is other things like trade or security cooperation or whatever. It's a lie.
That's Carn Ross there from Independent Diplomat. Nice to hear, Martin, isn't it? Some sort of sensible talk from ex-diplomats. Obviously, people who are currently serving don't have the freedom of speech.
Well, yes, and I think also what's happening is that they're making sure that the kind of people who will not toe the line no longer become diplomats. I mean, that's the other thing that's going on, a sort of debasement of the currency, as it were.
Okay, and also, as promised, we're going to have a look at one of the big, this is a YouTube hit of the year, but we haven't really had it at all reported here. It's to do with the infamous Operation Gladio. Just to remind us, Martin, what was Operation Gladio?
Operation Gladio is the code name for the setting up of what were called stay-behind groups in Western Europe at the end of World War II, recruiting many ex-fascists, incidentally, who were supposed to be the nucleus of a guerrilla army against Soviet occupation. But they became terrorists in their own right, manipulated by the intelligence services, and carrying out all sorts of terrorist attacks like the Bologna bombing of 1980 that killed 80 plus people. And it ultimately came to light that these terrorist groups were in fact being run by NATO intelligence services out of shape in Brussels.
And this particular piece, we won't play all of it now, just a bit about Gladio. It questions the official account of 9/11. It features Daniela Ganser, Nafiz Ahmed, Kevin Barrett, and architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Just tell us a bit about Daniela Ganser, because he's a Swiss guy.
He's a Swiss academic, and he's written the book NATO's Secret Armies, and he's an expert on Gladio. And, of course, when people say, well, was 9/11 an inside job, they've got to have the basic knowledge that NATO intelligence services have a track record, proven track record, of engaging in terrorism. So when we suggest that they carried out 9/11, it's simply a continuation of an existing policy.
I mean, these
policy.
Facts only came out from parliamentary inquiries, didn't they? That's in Switzerland, right, and Italy and Belgium.
Yes, but three parliamentary inquiries in Switzerland, Italy and Belgium concluded, indeed, that the intelligence services were behind these terrorist attacks. And Andreotti, who is the former Italian Prime Minister, admitted as much, as did the former president, of Italy. So, in other words, in many to those in the know, it's a well-known, determined fact that NATO intelligence services in the past engaged in terrorist activities. The question is, did they do 9/11? And the answer is, to my mind, yes, they did. Just like Bologna.
Whistleblowers leak U.S. talks with the head of Al-Qaeda. World Trade 7 is shown on Times Square. And the father of a Twin Towers victim tells us about being attacked by mainstream media.
Decades of terror against their own population blamed on extremists has actually been funded and planned by the White House. Top-level officials in the government and the CIA confirmed. Campaign known as Gladio is called by former CIA head Bill Colby a, quote, major operation. In sworn testimony, one of the conspirators confessed, "You have to attack civilians, the people, women, children, far removed from any political game, so authorities can bring in a state of emergency." Dr. Daniel Ganser, author of NATO's Secret Armies, thanks very much indeed for coming on. So mainstream media don't report this, but it is now on the record and officially documented that decades of terror attacks against their own population are in fact organised by the CIA and the White House.
Operation Northwoods, with evidence of Operation Gladio, we have the data now available. And then the people understand that this exists, but they still have a psychological moment where they have a hard time to believe that it still goes on, because it's bad news, you know. It basically means that terrorism can be manipulated in order to move people around like sheep, really. And if you're told you're a sheep and you're being moved by false flag terrorism, I mean, this is really something you don't want to hear.
Yeah, we keep finding this term, strategy of tension, by the White House. What does it mean?
strategy of tension actually means that you blow up a bomb and say your enemy did it. What we do have is evidence that this strategy of tension goes on. It's not over.
Bigger than Watergate, the FBI's Dennis Secker calls U.S. shielding al-Qaeda leaders up to 2001 and reports Veterans Today still ongoing. FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds has exposed the, quote, innumerable regular meetings between U.S. representatives and Bin Laden's deputy, now head of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Now, that was a clip there from Daniel Bushell, as the reporter on Rush Today. Martin, they're really blowing it wide open there, but not little or no reporting of Operation Gladio, it seems, in our press in the Western world at all.
Yes, I think it's very significant. If people were given the facts about Gladio, they would understand a lot more about what's going on in the current setup in the world. But of course, Russia Today has got an international audience, and they are basically upping the ante and saying, look, you know, we know what's gone on here, and we're going to broadcast it in English to an international audience. And it's important for people to understand that the NATO intelligence services, including MI6, including the CIA, have got a track record of terrorist activity.
Martin, isn't it the fact that back in 1999, Vladimir Putin also was involved, almost certainly, with a very similar sort of attack in Russia, blowing up apartment buildings in Russia and blaming it on the Chechens?
Indeed. And in actual fact, of course, Russia Today would be most unlikely to cover that particular false flag terrorist episode, although I stand to be proved wrong if they do. The point is that intelligence services, whether the FSB, KGB in Russia, CIA, MI6 in the West, they do engage in activities where they foment and engineer terrorism in order to steer people down particular political routes. So the strategy of tension in Italy was really geared around keeping the Italian Communist Party from becoming part of the Italian government. The strategy of tension pursued in Moscow in 1999 was again geared towards keeping the Communist Party of Russia from winning the presidential election in that year. So the purpose of these activities is to achieve certain political goals. And people can look this up for themselves. Just do a web search for Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O. It's the Latin word for sword. And you will see that there is masses and masses of evidence, which is mainstream stuff, it's not even alternative, that the Western intelligence services engaged in terrorism. And when they do get called up on it, they say, oh yes, we used to do stuff like that, but we don't do it anymore. Not that anybody's been punished or anything. And frankly, I just don't believe it. Once people are allowed to get away with that, and do get away with it, they carry on getting away with it. And until we put a stop to it, they'll carry on doing it. But I would say the strategy here is to get proper police forces, and I mentioned the police service of Northern Ireland earlier because it's not the Royal Ulster Constabulary. People like that need to get their finger out and start arresting some generals.
Okay, finally, and this is a bit of a nasty one for me. This time last year, I received death threats by phone from an international terrorist organisation, something called the Jewish Defence League. Martin, I know they're affiliated to the English Defence League, and they're actually classed as a terrorist organisation in the United States and here.
Well, they're older than the English Defence League. They carried out bomb attacks in the United States over 20 years ago, but they're affiliated with the very extreme right in Israel.
I mean, it isn't very nice to listen to this, so you might wish to switch off while you hear it, but I had a little app on my phone which recorded the conversation, so I was able to email it to the police.
Hello, Tony.
Speaking.
Hello, Tony. This is the Jewish Defence League. We'll be seeing you very soon, you piece of Nazi filth. You're a dead man walking.
And actually, the police were very good, Martin, weren't they? They went to London and found out where the call had taken place. The number was withheld, and people were interviewed.
Indeed. And that's what I'm suggesting that we should all do. I don't see the answer to terrorism as more terrorism. I see the answer to terrorism as enforcing the law. And the way to get the terrorists is not charging around the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan. Just go and have a look a lot nearer home and make sure it sticks.
I mean, even the Jewish people's own anti-defamation say the JDL consists only of thugs and hooligans. So anyway, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week again. We're online at www.thisweek.org.uk. This is Tony Gosling wishing you a very good weekend. And also, of course, don't let those banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.
live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, electricity companies are working to reconnect around 20,000 properties still without power across the country after more storms. Some have been off since the first storm on Monday. An amber warning remains in place in North Wales for this evening. Our reporter Fraser Maud is in Conwy.
The wind is dropping slightly now, which is a great relief to the people in this part of the country. 4,500 of them.